Welcome to Lung Cancer Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Ron Natale, and to get a better feel of how he incorporates recent research advances into practice, I asked him to present a few of his patients, and he began with a woman he first treated 10 years ago.
This is a 71-year-old woman, a nurse that I worked with, who's a never smoker. She developed a stage 2A lung cancer, an adenocarcinoma, and she underwent a left upper lobectomy and mediastinal lymph node dissection in June 1999. I saw her and treated her with four cycles of cisplatin vinorelbine, what we thought was one of the better chemotherapy combinations to use in this adjuvant setting.
Although I got to say, that was about 5 years ahead of your time, right?
Yeah, well,
Nobody was using adjuvant therapy in 1999, were they?
No, it wasn't the standard of care, but there were clinical trials and were in progress, and I was aware of the safety and the tolerability of this agent. And given that her risks of recurrence of her disease were, you know, about 50-50, and, you know, she was a healthcare professional, she was smart, we could have a pretty sophisticated discussion, I said, well, here's what I would do, and I think this will improve your chances. So she did well. I followed her for 10 years. And in 2009, I discharged her and I said, you know, we don't need to follow you with serial CT scans anymore. Well, she comes back to see me in June 2011 with headaches and ataxia, and a brain scan revealed three brain lesions consistent with a malignant metastatic process. Now, we obviously got MRI scans and everything to confirm all of that, and we did a complete workup. And our workup included the mammograms and endoscopy and colonoscopy, but the PET CT showed a large, intensely hypermetabolic mass in her left lower lobe. Remember, she had had a left upper lobectomy, left lower lobe, abutting the pericardium, with multiple enlarged and hypermetabolic mediastinal lymph nodes in the right paratracheal, the subcarinal, and the prevascular region. So pretty extensive, bulky disease. I consulted our neurosurgeon and neuroradiation oncologist. They performed stereotactic radiation therapy to the three brain mets while we proceeded to get a CT-guided biopsy of the left lower lobe mass. Now, we're doing these CT-guided cores quite a bit these days for a lot of our translational clinical trials. We've now gone from using a 19-gauge needle into which we put a 20-gauge core needle for the biopsy to an 18-gauge in which we put a 19-gauge needle. And we don't feel we've got an adequate core until it's at least 5 millimeters in length. And our routine protocol calls for getting a minimum of three. If we can get a fourth one safely, if there's no pneumothorax or other problems, we'll take that fourth specimen and flash freeze it. So we got three good cores. Each was 5 to 9 millimeters in length. And the pathology just revealed fibrous tissue, atypical cells, and inflammatory cells. And there was a tiny pneumothorax, no tube was required. So here's this patient who's quite concerned and terrified. We've put her through a pretty sophisticated biopsy procedure. She's getting stereotactic radiation therapy. You know, what do we do next? Do we simply say, well, we know that this is most probably lung cancer. Do we proceed with chemotherapy on the basis that we've got a malignant process in her lungs? She's developing some pain, some difficulty breathing. She's sort of saying, why don't you just give me chemotherapy? Or do we rebiopsy? And I believe the correct decision here is to rebiopsy. We certainly first, at the very least, need to confirm that this is what we suppose it to be, an adenocarcinoma of the lung, a recurrence of her original cancer. More importantly, in the time that's elapsed that this never-smoking woman presented with her lung cancer in June 1999, we've made some remarkable advances. So we did mediastinoscopy. Now, we've been doing a lot of EBUS, endobronchial ultrasound biopsies of lymph nodes, and we get enough tissue routinely to make a diagnosis. It's simple and it's safe, and it's adequate for staging the mediastinum. After doing this now for a couple of years with an outstanding group of thoracic surgeons, these are thoracic oncology surgeons, these are not cardiothoracic, we've dropped back now to doing mediastinoscopy with biopsies because we just can't get enough tissue to do all the molecular work we need to do. So she underwent mediastinoscopy. We got a generous amount of tissue. I ordered EGFR, EML4 ALK. That's at the top of my list. And if there's enough tissue, let's get a KRAS as well. Not because I've got a commercially available KRAS targeted agent, but you know, we have some studies that we're interested in. This tumor ended up being EML4 ALK positive. And I began her on oral crizotinib. I remember this vividly because the FDA approved this drug on a Friday, and I saw her on a Tuesday. So this was the first prescription for crizotinib that I wrote. The NCCN guidelines have just been revised, and so this was just issued. And in their guidelines, a couple of years ago, of course, they said that if a patient has EGFR mutated lung cancer, the preferred treatment first line for stage 3B4 disease is erlotinib. If they're EGFR wild type adenocarcinoma, the NCCN guidelines recommend several different chemotherapy combinations. Those guidelines went on to say that if you give a patient chemotherapy and subsequently find that they have EGFR mutated disease, you should add in the erlotinib to their chemotherapy. Okay. Well, the revised guidelines now have another pathway, that if a patient has EML4 ALK positive disease, the recommended first line treatment is crizotinib prior to chemotherapy.
So we're kind of making the leap of faith that the IPASS type paradigm that showed that's the way to go with EGFR mutations is going to play out this way too.
Exactly. And I think that I agree with that recommendation in the guidelines. I think that when one considers the objective response rate that we have with crizotinib in good performance status patients as this patient, that's 60% or higher. When you look at the duration of that objective response, and the data we have, of course, is second, third, fourth line setting, but the duration of that objective response in that late setting is in the range of 10 to 12 months. In the first line setting, we might even do a bit better. And of course, we continue to see some patients from the clinical trials that have been performed with crizotinib who remain disease-free even out to 2 years and beyond. There's a small tail of patients who do remarkably well, mirroring what we had seen with EGFR mutated disease treated with a specific TKI.
So I guess this woman's only been on it a few weeks. Do you have any idea what's going on?
Well, she's certainly feeling better. She's completed her Gamma Knife, had a little bit of fatigue from that, of course, but she's coming up for a follow-up chest CT scan that I usually get within 6 weeks of starting any of these oral agents. I don't wait 2 or 3 months.
Now, this lady had CNS symptoms with these brain mets, but if you had somebody who for some reason got diagnosed without symptoms and you knew they had one of the two mutations, would you ever consider just giving a TKI, holding off on local therapy? And have you ever seen people respond to brain mets?
Oh, yes, we have. With EGFR mutated disease, I've had a subset of patients who have relapsed in their brain. I've had some who have relapsed with meningeal carcinomatosis while their systemic disease remains under control. And in those patients, I've treated them with erlotinib once per week, a very high dose intermittent erlotinib, usually giving them 6, 7, or 8 tablets once per week. You have to make sure that you allow a washout from the daily dosing of erlotinib before you begin this. You need to allow at least 7 to 10 days. But what I think this allows is a very high blood level to be achieved in the first 24 to 48 hours. About 20% of that blood concentration gets across the blood-brain barrier. And so I think we achieve the therapeutic levels in the CNS by this weekly intermittent dose that we achieve systemically when we normally give the drug on a once-a-day oral basis. And I've had several patients who have had either dramatic regressions of tiny brain metastases that have recurred after their prior treatment with whole brain radiation therapy, so our therapeutic options have been limited. And I've had some patients with meningeal carcinomatosis who have had clearing of the malignant cells in their spinal fluid, normalization of their spinal fluid protein, and improvements in their neurologic status for at least a few months.
So again, does that mean that there are ever situations where you'll hold off on local therapy like radiation or stereotactic and just give the TKI?
Certainly, if the brain metastases have just been coincidentally identified, on a screening MRI scan, for example, and that happens often. And there's no peritumoral edema, the patient is asymptomatic. You know, since I know the response with EGFR mutated disease is quite rapid, I will be willing to hold off on radiation therapy and treat them with erlotinib, standard dose, for 4 to 6 weeks, repeat my CT scan to see if I've gotten a systemic response, and repeat the MRI of the brain to see if I've achieved a CNS response.
So one more question about this patient, which is that obviously she has a very delayed recurrence. And I'm curious how often you see it and what kind of situations you see this.
Yeah, no, I don't see this too often, that this type of recurrence, 12 years after treatment for her primary lung cancer. I think it does speak to the fact that disease in never smoking patients is a much more indolent disease and requires probably a different kind of follow-up. And I've begun to revise how I follow these patients. In my smoking patients, after adjuvant chemotherapy, you know, I see them every 2 to 3 months for those first 2 years. Non-smoking patients, I'm going to every 4 to 6 months for those first 3 years. My smoking patients, I will increase the interval after those first 2 years. We know that when they recur, 70-80% of them are going to recur within 2 years of their original diagnosis. And after that, it's less frequent. So after those first 2 years, I lengthen the intervals to every 6 months. And when I get out to 5 years, I'm quite happy. I might continue to see them once a year after that. Smokers remain at risk of developing a second upper aerodigestive tract malignancy. The rate is about 1 to 1.5% per year. So your so-called cured smoker with early stage lung cancer who receives surgery and adjuvant chemotherapy, 10 years out, they've got a 10 to 15% chance of developing a second aerodigestive tract malignancy. So you need to continue to be vigilant in those patients. But in these non-smokers, I think this case speaks to the fact that the recurrence process can be very, very indolent. We expected this. We know there are patients with peripheral adenocarcinomas, tiny lesions, that if you track them with CT scan when they're 5 millimeters in diameter, you've not wanted to expose them to an invasive procedure. Sometimes those lesions do not increase in size until 3 or 4 years later. So the responsibility for these tiny GGOs, or ground glass objects in the peripheral lung that end up being adenocarcinoma, to follow them up front in the diagnostic setting is longer. I think it's incumbent in the follow-up setting to follow them for a longer period of time. And here we want to achieve a balance. I think well-informed patients, my patient population in particular, are always concerned about the radiation exposure from these CT scans. So I tell them, yes, we need to achieve a balance of minimizing your cumulative exposure to the low doses of radiation in a CT scan over time with our need to continue to be vigilant. So this type of patient who I discharged after 10 years, perhaps some additional follow-up might have caught this a little early. It still surprised me that 2 years after a negative CT scan, you got to believe I went back and looked at it, and I couldn't find this lesion that ended up being about 7 by 4 centimeters in diameter in June of 2011.
Amazing. One other question I have to ask you. Again, looking back on her original adjuvant therapy with cisplatin vinorelbine 12 years ago, you know, way ahead of when we actually had the data, 12 years later, the same patient presents to you today. Which adjuvant chemo regimen would you likely utilize?
Well, today would be cisplatin pemetrexed. And of course, if they have an EGFR mutation or they have this EML4-ALK mutation, we don't know what to do. We don't know if we should include erlotinib or crizotinib into that adjuvant treatment setting. And that will have to be answered by clinical trials.
And we've seen a real shift actually towards cisplatin pemetrexed. There was some data actually presented at the ASCO meeting. It was kind of a cool data set. I think it was kind of a randomized phase 2 or something, but I think it compared cis-vinorelbine to cis-PEM in terms of toxicity and patients needing to come off therapy, kind of confirming what a lot of people had observed clinically. Any comments on that data set?
Well, I always start off with cisplatin, except in my very elderly patients in whom I have no hesitation in switching to carboplatin. When I use cisplatin, my intent is to try to get patients through 4 cycles of adjuvant treatment. I will follow their renal function quite carefully, and it's not uncommon that by that 3rd or 4th cycle, I have to back off and substitute carboplatin for cisplatin. So I agree with most of my colleagues that cisplatin remains the drug of choice in the adjuvant setting, combined with any other agent, including pemetrexed. But I think my patient population in Southern California is quite old. I have a lot of 80-year-old patients, and I use carboplatin pemetrexed with no apologies in that setting routinely.
Let's talk about your second case, a 79-year-old woman.
This is a 79-year-old woman with a 10-pack year history of cigarette smoking that ended in 1983. She underwent a left upper lobectomy with lymph node dissection in September 15, 2009, for what proved to be a PT1, PN0, MX, or stage 1A adenocarcinoma. Her surgery was complicated by an intraoperative tear in the pulmonary artery, so there was a lot of bleeding. She was followed thereafter with serial CT scans at about 3-month intervals and developed a new 1.5 centimeter nodular density in the left upper lung. Remember, this woman had had a left upper lobectomy, so this is part of the left lower lobe that is now expanded up into that space that was quite near the suture line, and developed this a few months ago in July 2011. So this was almost 2 years after her original surgery for stage 1A lung cancer. A PET CT scan was obtained. It revealed that there was hypermetabolic activity in this 1.5 centimeter lesion, SUV of 3.8, and borderline hypermetabolic activity in a small left AP window and left prevascular lymph node. And I mean small, these were 5 millimeter sized lymph nodes. The SUV was 2.3. So always puts us in that dilemma. Is this inflammatory? Is this malignant? What's going on? A cardiothoracic surgeon, and I underline that statement, cardiothoracic. This is a surgeon, a very good surgeon, does a lot of heart surgery and does an occasional lung cancer. I always prefer a thoracic oncology surgeon. But this surgeon performed a left thoracotomy with a generous wedge resection of this mass. The surgery was very difficult because there were extensive adhesions that probably resulted from that previous intraoperative bleed. He reported that he explored the mediastinum, but that failed to reveal any lymph nodes that could be biopsied. Pathology revealed a 1.6 centimeter adenocarcinoma, histologically identical to her original lung cancer in 2009. It came to within 2 millimeters of a 5 millimeter thick scar tissue from her previous surgery. So the margin in total was 7 millimeters around that lesion, the closest margin. Mutation studies revealed an EGFR mutation. So this gives me the dilemma of what do I do now? I have a lady who's had a local recurrence of an adenocarcinoma, a tiny one. It's been completely excised. We've not been able to sample the mediastinum, where the PET scan suggested the possibility of metastatic disease. Do I give her adjuvant chemotherapy? Do I give her adjuvant erlotinib because she's got EGFR mutated disease? Do I give her radiation therapy? You know, remember, she's 79. She's pretty healthy for a 79-year-old. But not the kind of person that I wanted to treat necessarily aggressively. The thought of concurrent chemotherapy, radiation therapy did cross my mind. Well, what I elected to do was repeat the PET CT scan 6 weeks after the surgery. What's going on with these mediastinal lymph nodes? And we did that actually just this past week. And her PET CT scan showed no adenopathy, no hypermetabolic activity. So I elected to follow her. I'll see her again in another 3 months with another follow-up PET CT scan. I'm, of course, nervous. I'm concerned that there could be other disease. But I think this patient, I'm hopeful, just had a tiny local recurrence, just coming right out of that scar area. and does not need adjuvant radiation therapy, chemotherapy, or erlotinib. This is a not uncommon dilemma that we face in patients that we've treated with curative intent. What do we do when they relapse? There certainly are those who relapse with metastatic disease. They're stage four, and the decision is obvious. You go on to first-line chemotherapy. But there are others who relapse locally. And my approach to those who relapse locally is to try to use effective local treatment. In most cases, that's concurrent chemotherapy and radiation therapy, hoping that they've not had micrometastatic disease, that's just stage four, where radiation therapy has no role to play. So there's no data on this, obviously. There are no randomized trials to guide us in the treatment decision, but we sort of have to use, I think, a common sense approach.
So I'm also curious, any thoughts about suppose she'd been 55 instead of 79?
Well, absolutely. If it's a 55-year-old and they're healthier, I would have given stronger consideration to treating that patient with concurrent chemotherapy and radiation therapy. I'd be concerned that the two-year interval in which this tiny focus of disease right at the surgical margin was able to recur and become visible on a scan, that it could have seeded a slightly wider region. This patient did not undergo completion left pneumonectomy. I think the thoracic surgeon wanted to preserve some pulmonary function. She does have some borderline pulmonary function on pulmonary function tests, and I agree with that decision, but you know, I might have more strongly considered chemo and radiation therapy to try to eradicate any other microscopic disease in the field.
So I have to ask you the question that we've been asking you and a lot of people for a long time, you know, kind of keep tabs on things, which is one of the most common questions oncologists have, which is where are you today in terms of using, you know, particularly, I guess, erlotinib, I think EML4-ALK maybe a little bit coming along in the adjuvant setting, off study, in a patient with a known mutation. You know, usually people think about it with younger people. Any times you do that?
Well, I enrolled a fair number of patients in the RADIANT trial in which they were randomized to erlotinib versus placebo for a two-year interval after completion of standard adjuvant chemotherapy, or were randomized if they did not receive adjuvant chemotherapy for another reason. And I await that data. I do not use erlotinib routinely as a component of adjuvant treatment in patients with EGFR-mutated disease. I get talked into it at times. I've got a very well-informed patient population in Southern California. I just saw a patient of mine who's a 49-year-old Korean woman who's a dermatologist. And so she's very well-informed and studied the data. I offered her the RADIANT trial 2.5 years ago. She refused. She did not want to go on the placebo arm. So she has self-administered, after getting cisplatin and pemetrexed, 4 cycles of adjuvant therapy for her stage 3A lung cancer. She had a tiny 2-millimeter focus of metastasis completely contained within 1 mediastinal lymph node. She's self-administered erlotinib for a 2-year period. And I saw her last week, and she's just now completed 2 years of erlotinib. She's done a wonderful job of managing the skin toxicity.
I guess so. Yeah. That's really fascinating. It's such a tough question. Let's finish out with your 76-year-old never-smoking Chinese man.
Yeah, so this presents another dilemma in this similar group of patients, slightly different setting. It's a 76-year-old never-smoking Chinese man who had multiple bilateral pulmonary nodules, and a CT-guided biopsy in early 2008 revealed a moderately differentiated adenocarcinoma with an EGFR mutation. Began him on treatment with erlotinib. He had a 20-month response, quite gratifying, improvement in his cough and his exertional dyspnea. He visited China twice, his homeland relatives, but in late 2009 has CT scan evidence of disease progression. I discontinued the erlotinib and changed him to carboplatin and pemetrexed chemotherapy. Now, I have heard of many physicians who continue the erlotinib, don't stop it, and simply add chemotherapy. And I personally don't like to do that. I like to cut the cord and move on to something else. I'm concerned that, as was the case in the large randomized trials in the stage four setting with the TRIBUTE trial, the TALENT trial of chemotherapy plus or minus erlotinib, results that mirrored the studies with gefitinib combined with CISGEM or carboplatin paclitaxel, in which we saw no benefit, that we believe that erlotinib can slow the proliferative rate of lung cancer and perhaps diminish the effectiveness of chemotherapy. But for this type of patient, there is no data to guide us as to whether erlotinib should or should not be continued. I'd like not to continue it, avoid the overlapping toxicities, and simply go on with chemotherapy. He achieved an objective response after the first two cycles of carboplatin pemetrexed. I gave him two additional cycles for a total of four and continued him on pemetrexed maintenance. Now, he's an elderly man. He was 76 when his diagnosis was first made in 2008, so he's coming on to 80. And I lengthen out his maintenance cycles of pemetrexed to 4 weeks rather than every 3 weeks because of that cumulative fatigue. So I'm trying to preserve the benefit and minimize some of the adverse effects. In late 2010, a follow-up CT scan demonstrated disease progression. So question is, what do I do at that point?
Can I just ask, what was your thinking in terms of, at this point, he had not had bevacizumab. Did you consider him eligible?
Yes, and I have patients that I've treated in this same setting or other non-EGFR mutated patients who I treat with carboplatin, pemetrexed, bevacizumab. I think that I'm not sure that bevacizumab augments the outcome of pemetrexed platinum-based regimens. I would like some data to help guide that decision. So I've not been consistent. I think for this kind of elderly patient, I was a little concerned regarding some of the bevacizumab toxicities. He's hypertensive, elderly. I want to avoid some of the adverse effects that bevacizumab might contribute to this combination, and I'm comfortable that carboplatin pemetrexed is a pretty well-tolerated regimen.
What about the possibility of using, I mean, you can't use it right now because one of the agents isn't available, so I don't know if there's trials out there, but maybe you can comment a little bit about the strategy of using the irreversible TKI afatinib with cetuximab in patients like that. That was just reported by Memorial et al. At ASCO.
Yeah, well, one always has to be careful about promising preliminary results from phase two trials, even randomized phase two trials. I think that the experience thus far with these oral TKIs and lung cancer have been uniformly disappointing. All of the randomized trials that have looked at carboplatin paclitaxel plus or minus, whether it's afatinib, whether it's vandetanib, whether it's sunitinib, have failed to demonstrate any survival advantage. So we've not been able to take the positive data from ECOG 4599 with bevacizumab and reproduce it with the VEGFR TKIs.
I'm talking about, you know, EGFR TKI, afatinib and cetuximab, because what I saw there was that, you know, pretty dramatic, you know, looked like, even though it was non-randomized, pretty dramatic benefits, including people with T790 mutations.
I remain skeptical that we're going to be able to use antibody to the external domain of the receptor and an agent that targets the internal domain, especially the mutated internal domain, and improve the outcome. I think studies have shown that when you use cetuximab alone in EGFR mutated disease, you do not induce apoptosis the way you do with the TKI that targets that mutated internal domain. At the biological level, the results are vastly different. Now, whether combinations can exploit some other aspect of the biology, I think remains to be seen.
Now, this patient did have an EGFR mutation, so it's a little bit different. But when you got out to chemo, you utilized pemetrexed maintenance after having received treatment with the carbopemetrexed. Can you talk a little bit about where we're at right now, particularly in EGFR wild adenocarcinoma, in terms of induction treatment or the initial treatment and then choice of maintenance, what the options are and kind of how you generally approach that?
Well, I think the paradigm has evolved to four cycles of induction therapy. I think the preferred regimen is pemetrexed combined with platinum. I think for patients with stage 4 disease, I believe the carboplatin is completely acceptable, that cisplatin is not required, but I would never quibble that one is better than the other. But for my patient population, I think carboplatin is well tolerated. We talked earlier about the possible addition of bevacizumab to carboplatin pemetrexed, and we'll see if this randomized trial in Europe shows any survival advantage. You know, the Europeans have not had a positive bevacizumab trial yet. The AVAIL trial was not. It showed a progression-free survival advantage outcome, but no advantage to overall survival when bevacizumab was combined with chemotherapy. In that case, cisplatin gem. I think after the completion of the 4 cycles, we now have several options in terms of maintenance therapy. If you use bevacizumab as part of the induction, certainly bevacizumab could be continued as part of the maintenance. There are no clinical trials in lung cancer that have shown or proven that maintenance bevacizumab contributes to the survival outcome. When we analyze the data we have, it does appear that it probably contributes to the survival outcome, but we don't have definitive data to support that. One could consider alternating to erlotinib as maintenance therapy based on the SATURN trial that showed that patients with EGFR wild-type lung cancer had a statistically significant improvement in progression-free survival and overall survival with maintenance erlotinib. It's well tolerated. It's compliant with our concept of switch maintenance therapy, switching to a drug that has a different mechanism of action. The survival advantage was quite modest, but when you look at the hazard ratio, so you look at the survival advantage over the entire period of observation, the hazard ratio was close to 0.8, so close to a 25% relative improvement in survival. And now we heard the results of the Paramount study, the preliminary results, the primary endpoint, progression-free survival, presented at ASCO and presented at the World Lung Cancer Conference this past summer, that showed that patients treated with first-line cisplatin and pemetrexed, 4 cycles of induction therapy, who were then randomized to observation versus treatment with pemetrexed maintenance therapy, that the maintenance arm had a substantial improvement in progression-free survival, a hazard ratio that gets down to 0.6, so a quite impressive improvement, a hazard ratio, in fact, that's so robust, we all expect that it will translate to an improvement in overall survival compared to the control arm. Of course, that remains to be proven, but I think it certainly opens the door that continuation of pemetrexed is reasonable. Now, this puts all of us in a very difficult position, especially if you used carboplatin, pemetrexed, bevacizumab as your induction regimen. People could contemplate using pemetrexed as maintenance, plus bevacizumab as maintenance, plus the addition of erlotinib as a switch maintenance with that. This would be an incredibly expensive treatment program, and we don't have clinical trial data that looks at all 3 of those encompassed together. I will point out that the ATLAS study that randomized patients in the maintenance setting to continuation of bevacizumab that was used with their induction chemotherapy alone or combined with erlotinib did not demonstrate the same modest improvement in survival that was demonstrated in the SATURN study, in which erlotinib was compared to observation. There was no bevacizumab. So paradoxically, the combination of erlotinib and bevacizumab continuation in the maintenance setting was not of benefit to those patients. That interestingly mirrors the results of the BETA study, in which in the second line setting, patients were randomized to erlotinib combined with placebo or combined with bevacizumab, although that study had a progression-free survival advantage, no overall survival advantage. So our concept of combining both an anti-VEGF drug and an EGFR-targeted agent, at least in the EGFR wild-type population, has now failed in 2 randomized clinical trial settings. So although Maintenance orlotinib would be a possibility for this patient treated with carboplatin pemetrexed induction. If it was carboplatin pemetrexed bevacizumab, I'd be a little concerned and a little wary of simply the addition of erlotinib to continuation of the bevacizumab.
So final question, we were talking before about cetuximab. Are there any situations right now when you consider the use of cetuximab outside a protocol setting?
The only situation I would consider in it is patients with squamous cell lung cancer, where when we look at the FLEX study, the benefit was really distributed across tissue types, histologic subtypes, and squamous cell cancer, a subpopulation for which we really do not have targeted drugs to augment the effectiveness of chemotherapy, cetuximab could be considered.
Let's talk about some new agents coming along, beginning with Stimuvax or BLP25.
This is a vaccine that's been prepared against an abnormal form of the MUC1 antigen, where there are more aspects of the core of that glycoprotein that are exposed, that raises the potential that immune reaction can be raised against it. And so Stimuvax was developed to target BLP25, and some clinical trials have been conducted, randomized phase 2 trials in lung cancer in patients with stage 3 disease and patients with advanced care, in which there was a positive signal. It showed that there could be an impact on survival by providing this vaccination for patients whose tumors express this antigen. So it's an important subset of patients. It's not just the whole general population of patients with lung cancer. It's an important subset.
So is there a way to assay for this antigen?
I believe there is, and I think that's going to be part of the overall process of both patient selection and approval of this agent. I think the phase 3 trials have now been completed, and we're anxiously awaiting to see what the outcome is. The phase 3 trial that I participated in took patients with stage 3 lung cancer who were treated with chemotherapy and radiation therapy, and then randomized them to the vaccine or not following the completion of treatment. So presumably these patients had a greatly reduced tumor burden, a situation in which we think that immunotherapy has its best opportunity to have an impact on the outcome. And I believe the patients were selected on the basis of expression, or at least stratified according to that, and we'll see what those results are. They should be forthcoming, I think, within the year.
So, you know, there's been a lot more discussion now about immunotherapy, although immunotherapy we've been hearing about forever, but, you know, ipilimumab in melanoma has gotten a lot of attention as Sipuleucel-T and prostate cancer. And one of the things that I'm starting to hear people talk about is kind of endpoints. And I know you're involved in terms of drug development in lung cancer. And I'm just curious because, you know, some people are saying, well, maybe you need to look at survival because you may not see the effect right away, which is kind of what happened with Sipuleucel-T. Any thoughts about how to evaluate these emerging immune agents?
I think that survival is going to remain the primary outcome for these studies. I think that's a requirement by the FDA, and I think scientifically it's important. I think there are a lot of things that can have a modest impact on progression-free survival, and certainly the impact of second and third line therapy, when there's imbalances, one group versus the other, can affect the overall survival, and you have the risk of losing a positive signal. But I think in the end, survival remains the common denominator.
Well, I guess the thing I've heard about is that you may not see sort of the immediate response with immune therapy that we look for with, you know, I guess targeted agents or even chemotherapy. Is that sort of your take on this?
I agree with that. I think we don't necessarily see tumor reduction. In fact, there have been some cases where there's been an increase in the size of the tumor, a modest increase, but patients were maintained on the treatment program and eventually appeared to have a possible survival advantage. So immunotherapy works by a markedly different mechanism than the cytotoxics and the targeted drugs that we're also very excited about. And it works in probably a slower process, where it takes the immune system time to really have a major impact on tumor growth and progression.
Now, you mentioned that you were part of a trial, and this is really, I guess, typical of a lot of emerging agents. You know, it looked at a situation where there were a lot of events, you know, post-chemo radiation for locally advanced disease. What other kinds of clinical situation? Is there a stage four upfront trial with this agent? And where do you see it being developed in terms of phase three, or where is it being developed in phase three?
I think most of these agents are trying to focus initially on patients who have lower tumor burdens and have at least had some positive effect on their tumor, either in the example that I gave you, the Stimuvax trial of patients treated with combined chemo radiation therapy, or in patients with advanced disease who at least have achieved an objective response with some induction cycles of therapy, and the immune agent is used in the maintenance setting. I think that excludes the most poorly performing patients with advanced lung cancer, and there are a lot of them, that if they're included in the denominator on both sides of a randomized trial, in both arms of the randomized trial, they could bury the signal of the positive impact on survival outcome. So I think that's a rational strategy to pursue with these agents that are quite novel and different mechanisms of action, where we can't use tumor regression, what we call the objective response, as a surrogate.
So as I mentioned, another agent on my list of things to try to figure out is ARC-197. Can you talk about what it is?
This is a drug that was originally thought to be a MET inhibitor. As is the case with all of these new kinase inhibitors, it may have some important off-target effects that were not known about when the drug was initially developed. And what I think is most exciting is that in some of the first studies that were done, for example, the study in Canada, the subset of chemotherapy, carboplatin paclitaxel, with or without ARQ-197, that an ad hoc subset analysis demonstrated that the patients with KRAS mutated lung cancer had the greatest benefit. So that came, I think, to me at least, as a big surprise. And this is a group of patients that have a more aggressive form of lung cancer. They are certainly more treatment refractory than any of the other subsets. We describe KRAS as a driver mutation, but unlike EGFR mutated and EML4 ALK translocated lung cancer, we've not been able to really develop a drug that targets this driver mutation. I think the aberrations in signal transduction that go downstream from mutated KRAS are probably more complex. And there are some centers that are looking at combinations of agents that target both the mTOR pathway and the ERK pathway. And along comes this drug ARQ-197, and voila, the KRAS mutated group appears to have the greatest benefit. So we're currently involved in an important study in which patients are treated with erlotinib plus minus ARQ-197. And it's an important stratification in this randomized trial. It's a trial that will involve around 1,000 patients, and the patients are stratified according to EGFR, wild type versus mutated, and according to KRAS, wild type versus mutated. And so that way we'll have the data that we need gathered in a prospective manner to determine if this drug in fact is effective in that EGFR wild type KRAS mutated subgroup that constitutes about 25% of this non-squamous or really adenocarcinoma population.
What about side effects with this ARC agent? You know, we see different things with TKIs, kind of hard to figure out what to expect. What do you see there?
With ARC-197, I think we're certainly looking at patients who have headaches, fatigue. There can be some skin rash problems. We're looking if there's an exacerbation of the erlotinib-induced skin rash. There can be some GI discomfort from it, some visual problems. But I think with all of these new TKIs, it's important as when we begin the developmental process that we cast a wider net in terms of looking for adverse effects than we've been trained to do with cytotoxics.
So in the same program that you're on is Dr. Spiegel, who also has presented some data recently, actually at ASCO, kind of looking at the same pathway with a similar strategy with a monoclonal antibody, MetMab, which again was combined with erlotinib. Can you talk about what your take was on that data and kind of where you see that strategy heading?
Well, I think the data with MetMab is particularly exciting, especially when they were able to go back and look at the expression of MET and identify that the subgroup of patients with a lower expression had, I believe, the better outcome. and that a simple immunohistochemical assessment of that might be sufficient to be able to enrich the population that can benefit from this agent. So I think it's quite exciting. I think that is an agent that I expect should make it through the development process.